So without any further ado, Bob Trimble, come on up and tell us about your sobriety.
My name's Bob, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
I, kind of a big crowd for me. I spoke at the Pacific Group a few weeks ago. And it's good to see Billy. I've known Billy for 25 years now. My sobriety date is November 24th, 1989. My sponsor is Matt Johnson, and I do have a home group. We are like men who have lost their legs, and I can't get Joe to change his home group, and that's fine. As long as he comes to mine, I'm okay with that. Let's see. I really don't have a pitch that I plan out. I just let God take charge, and so I'm waiting for Him to take charge. Come on, God. I come from a fairly normal family. Everyone in my family was either a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or they should have been. And I lost my father. He was 58 days sober, but he died. I just got here a little too late. He was 49 years old. I lost my mom in 99. She was 27 years sober. My aunt was 32 years sober when she passed. I lost my sister a few years ago. She was 52. My brother doesn't drink, and he smokes an awful lot of pot, but doesn't drink. And I lost an uncle strapped to a gurney at Camarillo Hospital. So it just ran rampant in my family. My father was a career Air Force officer. He was a bombardier on B-17s during the Second World War, and he came back from that war with what I think was post-traumatic stress disorder and a severe case of alcoholism. And both of those ran rampant in my family for the next 18, 19 years. Here's my dad. My dad, with two drinks, is the greatest guy in the world. I mean, he was smart, he was funny. Everybody liked my dad with a couple of drinks. With three or four drinks, he'd start to turn on you a little bit. And with five or six drinks, he would hurt you. And hurt you bad. And to a point where sometimes I couldn't go to school. And my mother was afraid that if I went to school, people would see the black and blue marks and the black eyes, and that would cause problems. We were living on Air Force bases. So I would stay home for a week. And so my relationship with my father was a little less than desirable. And it just, we traveled all over the country, all over the world, really. spent time in Germany and all over the South. And I went to 17 different schools before I graduated. It was not easy growing up as a military brat. And there may be a few military brats here. And I left home when I was 16. A lot of people leave home when they're 16, but we were living in Japan, and it was my mother had to arrange for me to come back from Japan on a troop ship, and my father wasn't really happy about it, but I did. I came back and lived with my aunt, and after I graduated from high school, he was stationed at Vandenberg, and I'd heard about California, and I would live in Ohio. It snows in Ohio. So I came out thinking things were going to be a little different, and things were not a little different. Well, they were different. As you know, it just gets worse. It doesn't get better. And I moved out. I actually was living in Santa Maria on Rose Avenue. Anybody live on Rose? Last time I spoke, somebody lived on Rose. But I was working out the base and going to Allen Hancock College I was doing well. I mean, I wasn't getting beat up, so I was happy. And I had to drop out of school for a semester because I was going to work full time and save some money and go back to school. When I dropped out of school, they changed my draft classification from 2F to 1A. And it doesn't take too long before you're drafted. And I was drafted on July 21st, 1965. And after basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and advanced infantry training in OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia, and jump school, and a year of jungle training, I was sent to Vietnam on my first tour. And I did my first tour with Bravo Company, 5th Battalion, 7th Cavalry Regiment, George Custer's old unit. I should have known then that something was not right. With the 1st Cavalry Division, and I'm not going to talk a lot about that. I don't ever talk a lot about it. But part of my story is on February 11th, 1958, about 1,500 meters north of the city of Way, which would later become known as the Tet Offensive. I got wounded for the second and third time that day. And I was out in the open field, and I was just laying there pretending to be dead because I didn't want to draw any more fire. A kid named Ashby Box came out to get me. And I was very disappointed at the time because they started shooting at us again. And they wounded Ashby through the hand, and I got shot through the calf. And they finally got me back. And a medic came up, and it was during the monsoon. It was cold. It was cloudy. It was raining. It was a miserable day. Obviously, it wasn't a good day for me. But a medic shoved an ampule of morphine in my left hip, and my whole day got better. Almost immediate. And wow, this is the best I've ever felt. Best I've ever felt. I can remember what to ask for it by name. Because I was never going to be an alcoholic. I'd seen what it did to my family. I was never going to drink, and I hadn't drank. I told Joe on the way up. I had my first drink when I was 21 years old at Hunter's Inn. It's not Hunter's Inn anymore, but I went into Hunter's Inn. And you get a free drink when you're 21. I showed him my, and he said, "Well, what are we going to have?" And I went, "Yeah, I don't know. Gin and tonic. I'm a big drinker, right?" I had a gin and tonic, and I went home. I'm not an alcoholic. I was not going to ever drink. And I got addicted to a Demerol in the Army Hospital in Hawaii. And they weaned me off the Demerol before they released me on convalescent leave, and I started to drink. And I'm the kind of guy that I just drink till I black out. I don't know how people stop. I just drink till I black out. And my story is basically I'm a blackout drinker who enjoys driving, and that's pretty much all. I can't tell you how many cars I wrecked in blackout, and I'm just lucky I didn't kill anybody, including myself. I ended up returning to Vietnam with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, getting wounded for the fourth time, and saying, you know, I'm not having a good time. I think I'll get out of the Army. Thank you, guys. And I did. I got released in July of 1970, and I'm back to school. And I'm not going to go into a big drunkalogue. I mean, everybody knows how to drink. I'd rather talk about recovery, so I'm going to kind of flash forward a little ways. And I know this is a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to upset anybody, but I did some outside issues along the way. Told Billy, I used cocaine once for about 17 years. And it was really that and Todd Heroin that brought me down, and brought me down hard. And I remember when alcohol stopped working for me, I was at the Sagebrush Cantina in Calabasas. It was Super Bowl Sunday, 1985, Patriots and Bears. And I couldn't shut my head off. My head was as sober as it's ever been, and I could barely walk. And I knew that I was in trouble, because I couldn't drink enough to shut my head off. And for the next 3 or 4 years, it went steadily downhill. I went into treatment facilities, 21-day detox. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous so much that people, they hated to see me come in the door. They said, "Oh, here's Bob." I was getting newcomer's elbow from raising my hand so much. It was just, I was really, and I just in and out and in and out. And today I know that I wasn't relating to anything. I was just looking at the differences. I could see my mom, I could see my dad, and this was not like a happy day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't, "Oh, I'm home." That's not my story. I was looking for someone that had been physically abused by their father. I'm looking for someone that had been wounded 4 times in Vietnam. I'm looking for this, I'm looking for that, and I'm not finding it, and I'm not disappointed that I'm not finding it. And I go back out again. what happened was the Veterans Administration has a place in Palo Alto for substance abuse treatment. Also, there's a place in Menlo Park for PTSD, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But in 1985, when I started to try to get sober, it was the first time I'd ever heard the term PTSD. I mean, it just came up on the DSM-4, and people were starting to talk about it. And they had mentioned it to me, and I said, oh, no, that doesn't bother me. That was a long time ago. It doesn't, you know. Okay. And what happened was I went to the VA to ask for some help, and there was a gentleman that said, you know, you've been out of the Army a long time. You're not qualified for any kind of care at the Veterans Administration. And I got really upset. I don't want it for I'm going crazy. And they brought somebody in to calm me down, and a doctor came and talked to me. He says, no, he was wrong. You qualify for benefits, and we have a treatment program here. And this is April of 1989. And he said, it's a long line. Maybe July or August we can get. I said, July, I'm going to be dead in July or August. And I knew I was going to be. I said, I can't wait that long. I got back in my car and started driving back to the city. I was living in San Francisco. And on the way up to San Francisco, Buffalo Springfield came on, for what it's worth. That song just tears me up. And I just started crying so hard I couldn't drive. I pulled over. And I had one good idea left. And if you've got one good idea left, I hope you go out and do that and get back here as soon as you can. But I had one good idea left. And I thought what I'd do is jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And so I drove out to the bridge. I drove across the bridge to the other side as a place to park. And it's a Saturday morning, and it's foggy. It's a miserable day in April in San Francisco. And I tell people that I didn't jump because there was nobody there, and I wasn't going to jump without a crowd, and that's not the truth. it gets a laugh, but it's not the truth. The truth is I thought about my mom, and her biggest fear was she was going to lose one of her boys in Vietnam. My brother was there the same time I was. He was a medic with the 101st Airborne Division and also got wounded. And I said, I just can't do this to my mom. And I went back to Ross Hospital, where I'd been through two or three times, and somebody let me detox at their house over the weekend. And on Monday morning, I went back to the Henry Olaf House, where I'd been once before and didn't last. And the Henry Olaf House is a wonderful men's home in San Francisco. And I spent 6 months there. I had a wonderful, I had an unbelievable time at that place. And you can only stay 6 months, and at 6 months I left, and I had an apartment, and I owned 4 Amco franchises at the time, and I was making way too much money. But what happened was, on Veterans Day 1989, I'm reading the San Francisco Chronicle, and there's an article in there about the headline is February 12th. And I'm reading this article. It's about these three guys who get back together every year on Veterans Day in San Francisco. And they're the only three men that are left out of their rifle squad. They lost their entire rifle squad on February 12th. And I'm reading this story, and I realize that these guys are from Charlie Company, attacking the same position I had attacked the day before, and lost their entire fire team, rifle squad. And I was in so much pain. I was so, I got loaded. I went down and bought some booze and ordered some stuff, and I was on a run for the next 10 days. I blamed that last relapse on my sponsor. And I know this is an anonymous program, but I'm going to tell you who it was. I was hanging out, not working any steps, but I'm going to a lot of meetings and I'm hanging out. And sometimes I come in a little late and leave a little early. In case you're wondering when the meeting's over, it's not over until we all hold hands and say a little prayer. Meeting's over. Some people need that information. They leave early, and it's like a death march out the door. I mean, every Friday night we have a big meeting, and as soon as the speaker's done, people leave. I mean, meeting's not over. So what happened to Joseph is when you're in trouble, you call your mom. And I called my mom. I said, Dina, I'm done. I don't know what else to do. And she called a gentleman that had been sober 35 years in San Jose, and he was a minister. And this is November 24, 1989 is Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving, and it's a Friday, and he came up on a Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And we sat down, and he brought a big book, and we read, started at page one, and we read through the book. And we're reading Bill's story. It's kind of interesting. The last time that Bill went out on a run was Veterans Day. They call it Armistice Day then, but it's the same day. And I said, oh, wow, I can relate to that. So now I'm starting to relate to somebody in alcoholics. This whole deal that we have was started by a combat veteran from the First World War. Started and suffered from depression and PTSD almost his entire life. And all of a sudden, I started to relate. And that minister said, you know, I didn't find God in the seminary. He said, I found God in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that made an impression on me. We got on our knees. We did the third step prayer. And I haven't found it necessary. Oh, I found it necessary to drink. I just haven't. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. That was November 24th, 1989. And I said I was, I had been embezzling money out of my business, which was okay with me. My partner wasn't too crazy about it. So I had to cut a deal with him, and I came down to Santa Barbara. I had a cousin living in Santa Barbara, and I ended up down there, and I got really active. What happened was, I'm a year and a half sober, and the first Gulf War broke out. I had done a whole fourth step and fifth step with my first sponsor. And we got all done, and he looked at it, and he said, you know, there's nothing in here about your dad. I said, oh, that doesn't bother me anymore. There's nothing in here about Vietnam. I said, oh, that doesn't bother. It's been a long time. I'm over it. No big deal. Well, when the first Gulf War broke out in 91, I started to go a little sideways. And I was carrying a 380 Mauser to meeting. I was on all the time. I had it in my car, and I carried it to meetings. And it wasn't a secret. I was patrolling the perimeter of my house at 1:30 in the morning, and disappointed when no one tried to break in. And a couple guys said, you know, Bob, this is not good. You shouldn't be carrying a gun around. And they sent me to the VA, and I started getting into treatment. And things didn't get better. I did a whole fourth and fifth step just on Vietnam, and it didn't get better. And they suggested, they said, well, we have this inpatient mental facility in Menlo Park. Just Vietnam veteran PTSD. I said, oh, I'm way too busy to be going up and spending 6 months in a mental hospital. They said, okay. A couple months go by, and it's getting worse. I can't sleep. I'm up all night. And I finally called, and I said, okay. Whatever I need to do, I'm ready to deal with this. And he said, well, we'll have this guy named Jim Dwyer, who does all the screening for PTSD for Menlo Park. We'll have Jim Dwyer call you, and he'll do the screening over the phone. And he called, and we talked for like 45 minutes. And he said, yeah, Bob, it sounds like maybe you've got some post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is August 6th of 1991. He said, well, we've got a long line of people that are ready to go. Is it going to maybe October, November before we can get you in there? I said, well, Jim, let me ask you this. what do I need to do to get somebody's attention? Go down to Vons and pop a few caps? And he goes, don't leave the house. I'll call you right back. And God love him, he called me right back. 2 days later, I was in Menlo Park. And I spent 6 months there. And I celebrated my second AA birthday at in a VA mental hospital. I don't really recommend that to anybody, but it's my story. And the last 10 weeks I was there, the last 10 weeks, there were 8 of us in this combat focus group. All the group was about was focus on combat. And we left there bleeding in the afternoon. I mean, just bleeding. And of the 8 of us that were in that focus group, there's only 2 of us alive. Only 2 of us left. And we lost the last one 3 or 4 months ago. His son had gone to Afghanistan, had come back and committed suicide, and he committed suicide shortly after that. And we lost 2 veterans in a matter of 2 weeks. But David's wife called. When David's wife called, I knew what she was calling about. But I got out of Menlo Park, and like I say, I was bleeding. And I went back to Santa Barbara, and the VA gives me a lot of money every month. It's not enough, but it's a substantial amount. And I wanted to go back to school. I've been driving a truck around. It was hard to find a job. I've got a master's degree at the time, and I can't find work because if people hire you, they want you to do more than sit at a desk and cry all day. They want you to actually do some work. So I had trouble finding a job, and I was a mess. And I talked to VA, and they're sending me back to get another graduate degree. And I went back to school and got a degree in psychology. And like Joe mentioned, I spent 20 years working in treatment. And it just, I left last year, I just got burned out. Really just got burned out. But I did that for 20 years. And I'm going to graduate school, and I'm working, and I'm interning at this place, Project Recovery, and I'm doing SB 38 and some PC 1000 work, and so I'm really busy. And when you're really busy, you have to cut back on something. So I'm cutting back on my meetings, and I'm going a little crazy again. It's just, and I'm not working with anybody. I really don't have a sponsor. I have somebody I tell people that he's my sponsor, but I'm not calling him. And somebody said, well, you know, you ought to call Matt Johnson. I said, no, Matt's kind of a Pacific Group guy. I think it may be a little hardcore for me. I need somebody a little easier. Maybe I'll call them. And a couple weeks go by, and I'm not getting any better. And I said, okay, give me Matt's number. And I called Matt. And he said, well, why don't we get together after Friday night meeting, and we'll talk. And I said, well, Matt, I don't go to the Friday night meeting. He said, yeah, I know. I'll meet you at the Friday night meeting. And okay. So I go to the meeting. I don't go to that meeting because there's 300 or 400 people there. I am uncomfortable with 300 or 400 people. I mean, I like it close to the door. This is a nice meeting. It's not 300 or 400 people. I'm close to the door. I'm okay. But I went to the meeting, and I was really uncomfortable. And so I'm ready to leave right away. And Matt's standing in line to thank the speaker. And I'm going, maybe he forgot we had an appointment here after the meeting. Then he's starting to put chairs away, and now I'm getting a little pissed. Come on, now. It's like he's cutting into my time here. Right? And then he's handing his phone number out and doing all these things, and finally he said, all right, let's go. I said, finally, all right. I'm standing around this whole time. We go have a cup of coffee, and the first thing he says, how many new guys are you working with? I said, well, I'm the only new guy I'm working with. I don't know about you, but I'm not working with any new guys. He said, well, we'll have to change that. He said, I want to get a greeter commitment at that Friday night meeting. Said, oh, Matt, oh, no, that's like a newcomer commitment. He goes, yeah, I know. I'm 5 years sober. And so I said, okay, I'm willing to take direction. So I go and I get a greeter commitment at that meeting. Now there's like 12 or 13 greeters at that meeting. It's a big meeting. And you don't start out like the number one. You start out way down at the end of the line. People were tired of being greeted by the time they got to me. And I stuck my hand out and I just did my job and greeted people and told them who I was, and they told me who they were and welcome to the meeting. And pretty soon people are going out, they're not coming back, and I'm moving up the line. I'm breaking in the new guys and girls. I'm breaking them in and telling them to keep the line moving. You don't want to, you know, I'm giving them all the tips on greeting. And pretty soon, I'm head greeter, number one greeter. And they had to pry me out of that job. I mean, I'm the head greeter. And something happened in that commitment. It just, one night I'm standing there and greeting people, and I realized I knew everybody by name. I knew everybody that coming into that meeting. I knew their wives, I knew who they were, what they did. I had just talked to them. I am not real good with chit-chat. Never have been. Don't give a shit how you're doing. I'm not telling you how I'm doing. Just leave me alone. And that's kind of the persona I put up. And people left me alone. They said, hey, don't talk to him. He carried a gun around for 6 months. I learned how to chit-chat, and I felt like I belonged somewhere. For the first time, I really belonged in that meeting. And there's a line you're going to have to cross if you're going to stick around here long. And it's the line between taking and giving. And I crossed over that line in that commitment. I've had a commitment at that meeting for well over 20 years now. And what happened is Matt and I went back and we started over on the steps again. I'm going to talk a little bit about step six. It's like a paragraph in the big book with step six. And I did this thing, and yeah, I'm ready now. And Matt says, well, what do you think entirely ready means? I'm like you're really, really, really ready. I'm really ready. And he goes, no, that's not what it means. So I think he's tricking me. I know what entirely ready means. It means really, really, really ready. He said, well, I'm going to tell you my definition. I have some things on my bucket list. And mentioned that I'm flying now. I'm going to get my pilot license in another couple weeks. I've been ready to get my pilot license for many, many years. I wasn't entirely ready until I got off my butt and went over and started taking some lessons. Entirely ready means you're ready to get up and take some action. And God's not going to remove anything from you unless you do your part. And the 12 and 12 talks about it. God will certainly remove your derelictions, but in no case does he leave you wide as snow without your full cooperation. So Matt and I sat down and made a list of the things I was willing to do to become a better man. He also said, we start talking about character defects. And I tell Joe and I tell all my guys this. Don't give me a list of your character defects. What I want you to do is give your wife or your girlfriend or your friend a piece of paper and pencil. Have them write some shit down for you. You'll find out your character defects. And that's what I did. And I was kind of surprised. Wow, that hurt. And we sat down and we outlined some action that I could take to become a better man. I got married, I got divorced, but maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. But I got married, and she had a daughter that was 18, and her daughter hated my guts. I mean, hate. She would not even acknowledge me. Just walk right by, not even look at me, not say a word. And it's my house. And she doesn't pick up a thing. She'll eat my food, but do you think she would get up and help carry the groceries in from Costco? No. So I called Matt one day. I said, Matt, that little bitch. doesn't lift a finger around here. Her room is a mess. She doesn't pick up anything. I hate to even look in there. And I go on and on and on. And Matt says, close the door, treat her like a newcomer, and he hung the phone up. Well, maybe he didn't understand how serious this is. But I started to think about it. Shut the door. I can shut the door. I can do that. Treat her like a newcomer kind of threw me a little bit. And how do you treat a stepdaughter like a newcomer? She would come home from work. Oh, Leslie, I'm so glad you're here. Keep coming back. She looked at me a little strange. But I kept doing it. Oh, I'm so glad you're home. I give her a hug. Keep coming back. Over a period of time, our relationship started to change completely. Change completely. She got married, and when she got married, before she got married, she came and asked me, she said, would you mind walking me down the aisle instead of my dad? And I said, no, I think that would be you. And I did. I walked her down the aisle. I used to take her when I spoke. I mean, I spoke at a chilly thing here, and I brought her with me. She wanted to come and see me do my deal here. And it's just all, you know, when we ask for newcomers and we sit around and wait for people to invite us into their lives, and it's not going to happen. You have to invite people into your life, and that's what I did with my stepdaughter. I invited her into my life. I'm waiting around for her to invite me into hers, and it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. I had to take the action and invite her into my life. And when my wife and I got divorced, she was hurt more than anybody. I called her one day to make amends and tell her how sorry I was that this is how this ended up. And I got her voicemail, and I broke down and sobbed on the phone, leaving her a message. And she never called me back. And her mom said she couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it. She was hurt so bad that she couldn't do it. And I'm sure one of these days we will talk. But it was a difficult thing, and I was, when Leslie was coming up to visit us, to live with us, a long visit, we had a little apartment in the front of the house, Mitchell Trina, and we're putting, you know, new floor in, and we're redoing the bathroom and a new shower, and my job is painting the walls, and I'm painting the walls. They were green. It was an ugly green. And so I'm painting the wall kind of a light taupe. And my wife comes in, and I'm painting. And she says, oh, you left some brush marks over here. I threw the paintbrush. I'm painting yourself if that's not good enough. I'm really angry about it. She looked at me kind of surprised, and I started to walk off, and I went, all right, let me tell you what happened there. And she goes, yeah, I'd like to know what happened there. I said, my dad criticized everything I ever did. Nothing was good enough. Second place, first loser, pal. I said, what happened was you started to give me some feedback on painting, which I took as criticism, and I attacked my dad. Unfortunately, you were standing there. She said, well, what do your AA friends tell you to do about that? I said, I don't know. I don't know. I was in a 12 and 12 study, and I can remember the page. This is what it says on Battle of Faith 79. And we're reading this, and I'm in a 12 and 12 study. And I know it's about my dad, and I don't know what I'm going to do. It says, in many instances, we shall find that though the harm done others has not been great, the emotional harm we have done ourselves has. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they may have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personality and altered our lives for the worse. I went, that's what it is. the emotional damage I'm causing myself and others around me because of my relationship with my father has to do with making amends to my dad. And when I was 90 days sober, I went back to his grave in Florida, and I had my 60-day chip, and I shoved it down his headstone. He's buried in a military cemetery there. And I crossed him off my list. He's on my amends list. I crossed him right off. And, you know, people say, well, it's grace out of men's. And I don't know how grace out of men's worked for you, but it didn't work that well for me. I'm still. And the deal is what kind of emotional harm do we cause ourselves? We look at that in the fourth step. I mean, people look at the third column, and all I hear about is character defect, character defect, character defect. It's the emotional conflict that we cause ourselves in the third column, where I never got loaded over character defect. Never had a drink over character defect. My wife gets mad at me, I get in trouble at work, you get mad at me, I don't get loaded. I get loaded over the stuff in the third column. And that's what was causing me all my problems. Romance and finance, third column, not fourth column. Third column. So, I know it has to do with amends, and we moved up on the Mesa, and I got the house in the divorce. But beautiful house, four bedrooms, overlook the ocean, and I have an office, and I'm putting up my shadow box from my military service on the wall. My wife comes in and says, why don't you do one of those for your dad? And I'm like, you know, that's how bad my relationship is with my father. I couldn't see that. She saw it. I went, gosh, that's a good idea. I wish I'd have thought of that, but I didn't. And I sat down, I ordered all his medals, his flight wings, all his stuff, and I put it in a shadow box. I put it up on my wall. His is bigger than mine. So I get online to order one the same size as my dad, and I'm going to put all my stuff in it. And I'm ordering it, and it comes with a brass plaque, and you can type in whatever you want and grade on the plaque. And I type in Robert J. Trimble III, and I just started to cry. My wife heard me, and she comes in, and she says, she looks, and she said, I didn't know you were a third. And I said, I haven't used that in 50 years. I hated it. I hated it. But at that moment, I became my father's son. All that stuff immediately went away. I don't know what happened. It just went away. And his shadow box is still on the wall in my office. And there's a veterans museum in Santa Barbara, and if you know where the veterans building is, down on Cabrillo, they have meetings there all the time. If you go into the room, the Cabrillo room, where all the shadow boxes are on the wall, I nominated myself and my father for the museum a few years ago, and both of our shadow boxes are hanging together in that room. It's the only way I had of honoring my dad now. And all that stuff. Yeah, it hasn't been a good year. I've went through a divorce. Divorces are not easy. I mean, it's a sad thing. And someone's going to get hurt. And I didn't get hurt, but it was sad. I mean, we've been together 10 years, and it was difficult. It got more difficult because I got in a relationship from hell. And I had my ass handed to me in a brown paper bag is what happened. And my ego was so, I mean, it was just, I went through a terrible time. And I'm just, you know, coming out of it. And I was at a meeting this morning. Yeah. This morning. I'm at a meeting this morning, and there's a newcomer, and he talks, and I love newcomers because they tell the truth. They don't know. They don't know. They call on him, and they just tell the truth. And one guy was talking about how terrible his life is. Oh, right on. I love that. You're in the right place, pal. And the other, they called in somebody else, and he said, I love misery. And I went, yeah, me too, I must love it because I manufacture it. I manufacture it, sometimes deliberately. And I started, my birthday was yesterday. And one thing about getting older, you have more time to reflect on. And I did a lot of reflecting. And I was reflecting on misery today. And because I don't want to manufacture misery. I mean, I don't do it on purpose, I don't think. But I used to run through people's lives, and it's kind of like payback time, without any consideration for their feelings at all. And I got sober, and I had my sex inventory, and I said, I need to start calling some people and making amends. And I told you I didn't have a sponsor, so I'm doing this on my own. And it did not go over well. I would not recommend doing that without talking to somebody first. And people were like, yeah, I'm glad you're not drinking, but leave me alone. I never want to see you again. I'm going, wow, they're pretty angry. And I was thinking today, it's about not engaging. It's about not engaging. And my problem is I engage and create misery. That's what I do, I engage. And so the new thing for me is not engaging. And not engaging is not a sign of weakness. It's really a sign of strength. There's freedom in that. There's freedom in just backing off and not engaging. And I've been sober 25 years. That just came to me today. Who knew? All because a young kid this morning said, I love misery. And I was right with him. I was right with him. My mom came up and spoke in Santa Barbara, and I'll probably end with this. She spoke on a Sunday night, and Billy might have been there, but it was, she got up and she started speaking, and after about 5 or 6 minutes, she said, you know, I can't really remember anything, and she sat back down. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, oh, it must be a senior moment or something, and she went back to Sun City, and she had a brain tumor. And her eyesight was going all of a sudden, and they operated, and it was malignant. And my mom was going to die, and we all knew that. And I went down, and I'm sitting with my mom, and I'm holding her hand. I'm going, this acceptance bullshit. I don't accept this. I'm not going to accept this. I'm really angry about it. And she goes, oh, Bobby, she said, acceptance is my job. Your job is spiritual growth. And she hung on, and she passed away on Veterans Day, 1999. And I know she did it on purpose. I know she did, just to take some of the power away from Veterans Day. But I had 10 years of sobriety with my mom before she passed. And her favorite line in the 12 and 12 is on the last page of the second tradition, where it says, sometimes the good is the enemy of the best. And we talked about it a few times, and I acted like I understood what that meant. So I'm talking to I met my ex-wife at a party, and I wasn't drinking. I'm the only one not drinking. And she said, you don't drink? I said, no, I don't drink. And we talked. I didn't know I was going to be talking to her this long, but it ended up being a long conversation. And finally it came up that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. She goes, oh, that's a cult? And I went, it is? They don't accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. I said, well, I'm in this cult, and it's working out real well for me. I haven't had a drink in a long time, and we started dating, and she'd come up, and I took her to the Friday night meeting, and I took her to this cult, and we're driving home after the meeting, and she's really quiet, which is kind of unusual, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, nothing's wrong. I'm just thinking, I've been a Christian my entire life, and I've never been in a room with that many people in it, where the spirituality is a matter of life and death. And she got it. She got it. So I'm talking about this good is the enemy of the best thing. She said, oh, that comes out of Scripture. And I said, you say that about everything. She says, no, it does. And she went and got a book. Gave me the book. It comes out of the Scriptures. I didn't know that. The deal is, there's some shepherds in the Middle East, and I guess there's a lot of desert and stuff there. And he and the sheep had been without water for 3 or 4 or 5 days, and they're going to die, and they're dehydrated, and they come across some pools of stagnant, muddy water. And the sheep and the shepherd drink the water. They don't die. They get real sick. They get dysentery. They get sick, but they don't die. The deal is, if they go on just over the next little hill, they get about all the cool, clear water they wanted, and they settled for the good at the expense of the best. Now, the next time they go through there, the shepherd knows about the water over there, but the sheep don't. The sheep want to stop at the muddy water again, and the shepherd had to beat and cajole them and get them going to the clear water. I'm going, I'm reading the book, that's my sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. They beat us and they drive us, and the deal is this. You know, if you came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you just wanted to stop drinking, it's like getting a whole book of e-tickets for Disneyland and riding the monorail all day long. There's so much more here. So I hope that you all drink cool, clear water. Thanks for having us up tonight.
That's great. Let's give Bob another round of applause.